Hello, and welcome to the Lawfare Podcast. I'm Benjamin Wittes. Our subject today is the current legislative machinations over cybersecurity. On Friday, I sat down with Paul Rosenzweig, who served as a senior policy official at DHS in the last administration, and who has been blogging for Lawfare on the current cybersecurity legislation, and with my colleague Alan Friedman, a fellow at Brookings who works on cybersecurity and privacy issues. In this roundtable discussion, we talked about the various cybersecurity bills and the policy disputes that lie beneath them.
Paul, start us out. What is the state of affairs in the legislative discussion, and how did we get here?
Well, we started, I guess, back in May of last year when, after several years of consideration, what's reported to be a significant amount of infighting within the administration, the Obama administration published a comprehensive cybersecurity legislative proposal. It contained everything from completely unobjectionable modernizations of FISMA to enhancements in criminal law to changes in authorities. It was everything that they could possibly want to talk about in the field. Their things lay over last summer until there started to be some movement in the House. There are a couple of competing bills there. The simplest one is the Rogers-Rupersberger's bill out of the House Intelligence Committee, a bipartisan bill that is essentially information sharing of cyber threat and security information with nothing else. 13-page bill, basically. Its major competitor in the House is the Lundgren bill, which has come out of the House Homeland Security Committee, which has both a very much more robust and administratively complex set of rules for information sharing on cyber threat and vulnerability information, plus a strong but not mandatory mechanism for setting cybersecurity best practice standards, basically. Those two bills are both awaiting House floor consideration, and that probably will not come unless and until the Senate acts. The Senate is where the major action is right now. Majority Leader Reid has promised that he will bring a cybersecurity bill to the floor sometime this work session, but, you know, as with most things, Senate, it may delay until next work session, for all we know. And there are two really divergent competing proposals on the Senate side right now. The original one that came out earlier this year is the Lieberman-Collins bill. It's out of the House Homeland Security and Governmental Senate Homeland Security and Governmental Affairs Committee. It is bipartisan in the sense that Susan Collins is on it, but she is notably the only Republican on that bill. It contains a very strong information sharing, threat and vulnerability information sharing set of rules, but with some liability provisions that retain private rights of action for a few of for people who are aggrieved that are of some concern to the private sector actors. So that's kind of information sharing, but with a bit of a nod to the privacy and civil liberties groups, if you will. Most notably, it contains what will turn out, I think, in the end to be a mandatory regulatory system that will identify critical infrastructure and require the adoption of best practices for information systems attached to critical infrastructure. Think the electric grid. I think that it's the regulatory provisions that pretty much generated the significant pushback. The other competitor is the McCain bill, which is interesting because McCain and Lieberman are obviously socially and politically best of friends, and yet here they are on opposite sides. The McCain bill takes all of the criminal provisions that President Obama wanted, so it's the only place that Obama's criminal provisions
They were in
appeared.
The Leahy bill.
They were in the Leahy bill, but that's... The only one of the major competitors, yes. I will say that, to show up. And and a very strong information sharing provision set of provisions that looks much like the Rogers-Ruppersberger provisions without a lot of limitation at all, and absolutely nothing in terms of regulation, absolute dead silence in terms of whether or not we're going to create a new regulatory regime. So the way it looks to me in the Senate, we're going, the most significant decision will be how Senator Reid brings these bills up. If he brings them up with the Lieberman-Collins as the presumptive leader and the McCain bill is an amendment to be offered that can't get its 60 votes, the Republicans probably won't even let this come to the floor because that's obviously, in their judgment, a rigged game. If he brings it up in a form where the two bills are equal, fair competitors and the one that gets 51 wins, we might actually see an interesting, lengthy, substantive debate over cybersecurity.
Alan, how do you what part of that do you that analysis do you share generally? How do you see?
I think that's a good analysis. My challenge is this idea that the bills seem to be working at orthogonal purposes. Not they're cross purposes. It's that they don't seem to have this shared view of what the problem we're trying to solve is. And one of the challenges in cybersecurity is we lump in all of these complex issues that touch on many different laws, and we put them all into the same heading, and then we get surprised that it's such a complex issue. So one thing that we can do as we evaluate these laws is say, well, what are we trying to address? And we have the crime side, we have the national security side, sort of long-term threats to our critical infrastructure from determined attackers, and then we have economic and intellectual espionage against American private actors. And it is true that information sharing is often thrown out as a silver bullet, and of course there are no silver bullets, but information sharing is at the same time something that's hard to be against, because from a policymaker's perspective it's cheap, you don't have to do anything, but we seldom get to the second step of who is sharing what information with whom and why. And my chief criticism of the McCain bill is one, you can share with anyone, which means that we're now imposing on the back end the further need to do massive coordination of sharing of information between the different groups. So most of the organizations that McCain authorizes as cyber information centers are inside the national security or the defense establishment. They're behind the national security wall, but he does allow the FBI and the DHS to have one center each. These are not organizations that, you know, play super well together on information sharing. We've made progress, but this is an ongoing battle that everyone recognizes is an open battle. And just the idea that that would be enough seems to stop, right? It is certainly a step that we should make. It's unclear to me why they should be that should be sufficient.
So let me ask you, how do you assess what the likely play out in the Senate looks like? I mean, does Reid make the judgment, well, let there be an open competition between these two bills, you end up getting something that looks much less dramatic than what he probably prefers himself? Or does he say, let's, you know, kind of take the risk and push for something quite aggressive, much more aggressive, and have a cloture problem as a result?
So I can't speculate on what I think Reid is going to do. I think that Paul will have some much better insights on that. What I can say is what I'd like to see is first, of course, hearings, but so the specific context is a better imagination of what this sort of top-down command and control is going to look like on the information infrastructure. So the philosophy behind the Lieberman-Collins bill is there is lots of critical infrastructure that is not under direct control of the government or even under indirect control of the government outside of some narrow industry side regulations. And because those regulatory structures are all built around the very specific purpose of each of these infrastructures, whether it's air traffic control or power delivery, That's what those organizations and legal infrastructures have been built around. So what we need to do is have a common unified way of evaluating risk, prioritizing risk, and then figuring out how we're going to assess it. It's very important to note that we haven't set up what we're going to demand. And we can imagine a certain type of regulatory regime that looks like other Obama tech policy regimes, which is you get the big players in the room and you put the cudgel of regulation in front of them and you say, are you going to fix this or are we going to have to do something? And that's what the Obama administration has done inside the FCC and Department of Commerce. So that would be the ideal way this turns out on the policy front. Communicating that ahead of time might be politically risky because that takes away the threat of a real regulatory power.
What do you think, Paul?
Well, that's an interesting question. I spoke to somebody who was in the recent administration briefing on cyber that happened in the Senate, and he said that it was really there were even of two minds in the administration. Some of the administration officials were saying things like, well, if we can't do it all, let's do the information sharing, because if we all just did only information sharing, I have no doubt that some form of compromise that answered a number of Alan's questions and responded to some of civil liberties' concerns and some of McCain's concerns would actually be developable. And so there were some of the officials who were saying, let's get what we can, because it is cheap, it is moderately effective, and it's better than doing nothing. They were sat upon by some of their more senior peers in the meeting who were saying, no, we don't want to do any half measures, which is exactly what the line was out of the administration's press offices after this briefing, that doing just the information sharing without the regulation would be a half measure and no good, indicating that at the higher levels, the political judgment has been made that it is better to try for the whole enchilada and perhaps fail than to not try at all. I sort of assume that in the end, whatever the administration wants will be the guide for whatever Reid tries to lay before the Senate.
And what about the Republicans? Is your sense that they are unalterably opposed to a significant regulatory dimension, or is this an effort to say, okay, we agree with you on we'll work together on the information sharing, but we need to have a negotiation about the scope of any regulatory authority here?
Well, if I had to project again, I would say that the regulatory regime is a red line. The image, DHS would do the regulatory regime, does not have, I used to work there, I love the people there, I think they're great, but it doesn't have the greatest reputation for effectiveness, broadly speaking. We've recently gone through the Chemicals Facilities Anti-Terrorism Standards, the CFAT standards, which is a regulatory regime that Congress created and gave to DHS. We're now 4 years into it, and the recent GAO report says we're $400 million without a single regulation. So the mantra is kind of, if you liked CFATs, you'll love whatever we call the computer, the cybersecurity set. So I'm sort of guessing that it's a real breakpoint. The only real question I have is actually the flip of that, which is for how many Democrats is agreement to an information sharing regime that has some provisions that might annoy privacy and civil libertarian groups that are more in their camp, how many Democrats is that agreement to information sharing conditioned on the existence of the regulatory regime? And I don't know the answer to that.
Let me ask you, but before you jump in, Alan, when you say the regulatory regime is a red line for presumably industry and some conservatives, what's your sense of the optimal policy on that? I mean, is it a situation where that's an example of where a certain ideological orientation and a certain set of interests coincide And that's a bad thing, or is it an example, or you know, or is this not an example of an area where regulation is promising?
Is this one of those softballs where I say I wrote a paper for the Hoover Task Force on National Security and Law on that very topic? I am generally of the view that this area of law is too dynamic and fast changing for traditional command and control regulatory structures. I tend to think that information, cyber threat and vulnerability information, is a classic public good that does call for government intervention, but that most of the other security products that are in the bundle of cybersecurity, like firewalls and intrusion detection devices, are more closely akin to private goods, granted with some externalities. But if we regulate in this area, I'm afraid of, besides the slowness of the regulatory process, a lot of rent seeking, so that you know, privileged actors will get not the rules that are optimal for us, but in the tradition of Washington, the rules that the best lobbyists can buy.
What do you think, Alan?
I like the point about rent seeking, but I think ultimately the challenge we face is twofold. We need to promote investment and coordination. Investment in that I don't think that private actors have a strong enough incentive to understand their risk and to invest accordingly to prevent that risk, especially when that risk is social in the realm of critical infrastructure, and especially when we're worried about resilience in the face of long-term national security threats. Resilience is inherently inefficient. So if we're trying to build out inefficiency, you need to have some sort of incentives. Get back to incentives in a moment. You also need coordination. We need to understand the threats and coordinate to prioritize where we should be investing. Part of that is information sharing. But I think information sharing is only usefully understood in the context of a broader coordination effort. Now, this can be decentralized. There are private actors who can make much better use of different types of information. But then again, you don't want to be going through the government in the first place if that's really your philosophy. And there's a centralized component as well. When we talk about information sharing, of course, what kind of information? So you have technical details. I need a technical signature of what this attack looks like in real time, and you need to push this over to me automatically, right? We're talking something that happens on the loop, faster than human capacity, no human in the loop. And that's a technical architecture that has to be set up inside an organizational architecture protected by legal frameworks. You also need, what are the bad guys after this quarter? And that's bringing in CISOs, both government and private sector, and having them talk in a room. Again, you need a different type of protection to allow them to share different type of information. But the idea that we can just information sharing enough doesn't hold. Going back to the challenge of investment, you have carrots and sticks. The problem is carrots cost taxpayers money, and sticks, you know, impose costs on the private sector. The only free tool we have is liability protection. So there are two problems with talking about liability protection now. One, it's really early, right? This shouldn't be the first thing that we throw out. Because once you offer liability protection, you can't offer it again. And two, we don't really have liability right now. So we should, you know, move towards a liability regime as a stick so that we can use liability protection as a carrot to drive good investment.
Do you agree with that, Paul?
You know, I'm reminded of the joke that the proper thing we should have done in Afghanistan was send in the lawyers. And if we just dropped a dozen American lawyers, that would have cowed the Taliban. You know, liability regimes are more efficient than regulation.
Steve Bannon being an economist rather than a lawyer.
Yeah, I will start with that. On the other hand, you know, lawyers are that little, you know, black triangle where the demand and the supply curves don't cross because they're dead weight loss. And we are part of the dead weight. I think the more important, you know, kind of problem or objection is you can't construct a liability regime kind of out of whole cloth. Mm-hmm. And so in terms of dealing with where we are now, today, My own take is, let's try the easy stuff. You know, information sharing is comparatively, chip shot, right? More criminal sanctions against the criminal bad guys, readily doable. We need better international coordination, but that's, but you know.
If we saw good science that said that increasing penalties deters bad guys, I'd be completely behind that. Now, there are, in the cyber world, there are enough cases where we haven't criminalized some of the things that we do want to criminalize. Mm-hmm. And of course, and I don't know the law, you may have some thoughts on this, how much are all the new laws harmonized against what the rest of the world is doing? Because the number one priority on punishing bad guys is making sure that our definitions are legally coordinated with everyone else.
Well, I mean, that is a legitimate point, which is to say that unless and until Russia and China are playing, and Ukraine, which are havens, are playing the game with us, criminal law will have few answers. But that suggests, I mean, if that's really the problem, that doesn't suggest a regulatory regime, that suggests a diplomatic effort in the G20, or, for me, the problem with the regulatory regime is that it's answering the wrong question. Because that regime is about, massive threats to our critical infrastructure from determined state actors. For my money, that's a prospect that is, low probability. It's the same probability as a shooting war with China at the moment, right? Which is to say, pretty darn small. Now, over the horizon, I can see irrational actors getting this capability, the Al-Qaedas of the world or the Anonymous or other hacktivists, but they don't have it yet, right? So we've actually got some time to see if these other things work before kind of driving over the cliff of regulation.
Let's talk about the criminal side. I'm, first of all, Alan, in your judgment, what are the areas where things that should be criminalized are now legal? I want to know specifically so that I can do them while they're still legal.
So it comes down to sort of smaller definitions of what does it mean to run a botnet exactly? How does that play into the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act?
Explain for listeners who don't know what a botnet is and when it's legal and when it's illegal to be running
sure.
One.
And Paul may have thoughts. Again, not being a lawyer, I can't give you the exact details, but I can. So a botnet is the ability to control multiple machines to do your bidding without the permission of the owner. So this is classically illegal under the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act. I'm using it without the express permission of the owner, of the authorized owner. However, because defenses have gotten better on the technical side to find the people running these botnets, because you just look for someone who's talking to a whole bunch of computers in a network, now we have much more complex architectures with many more middle layers. And so the challenge of working backwards to find someone, once you actually find the guy who's controlling things, actually showing what they're doing is a violation of the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, can be hard. Example here is Spain, which had a law that looked like the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, but a judge ruled that there was nothing in there that actually referred to being the puppet master behind a botnet, because you weren't personally involved in taking over each computer. It was not illegal to do that. So the challenge is in sort of understanding these definitions properly.
I think that's right. On a global scale, American concepts of conspiracy and aiding and abetting and accessory are not universal. And, in America, we'd probably be able to address that, though there are some courts that have expressed some concerns. But it's, we live in a world where the bad guy can be in Spain.
But isn't that you both alluded to this earlier, that it requires a level of coordination in the substance of the criminal offenses between, mm-hmm. frankly, countries not like Spain, which does have a interest in controlling mm-hmm. This sort of activity, but in countries that not only don't have an interest in controlling it, but have an interest in being havens.
So in China actually has, in the last 9 months, really stepped up their game on a number of types of enforcement. For example, in registering fraudulent domains, which are critical for controlling behavior on the internet. You use the domain name system by registering a whole bunch of domains, and that way you can play the police have to play whack-a-mole. The bad guys have sort of moved around as various governments have stepped up internal enforcement. So I think on some levels, China has taken more action. Russia is less tolerant of what we call bulletproof hosting than they used to be. Bulletproof hosting is this idea that I have a computer. In order to get data on the internet, it needs to sit on a computer somewhere. And so why not just go after the guy that you plug that computer into, your host on the internet? And there are organizations that charge extra money in exchange for ignoring letters from lawyers, no matter how strongly worded they may be, until someone actually kicks down the door. And Russia has gotten better at least not tolerating certain kinds of crime.
And do you see that as a response to diplomatic pressures? What drives that change?
I think it's, in some cases it's diplomatic pressure. In some case it is global pressure. So on the in the domain registration question, it's becoming increasingly, there's more visibility in the space, and as such, national registries can't ignore irresponsible registrars inside their country, so they have to exert pressure downward. Similarly, network providers in a global context, major providers around the world will say, hey, listen, we've got all this bad traffic that's coming from your network. And the large networks in Russia look downstream four or five hops into their network and see there's someone who's a bad actor and start to exert that kind of national corporate control.
Mm-hmm. So is this then kind of a problem that even without major legislative intervention, lots of it will take care of itself over time?
It won't take care of itself. I mean, crime is endemic. We haven't gotten rid of murder either. But if crime is the problem, you know, is a regulatory structure, even information sharing, are those kind of the answers? Crime's the problem. It's, you know, better international cooperation, a few more cyber cops, maybe some enhanced criminal law, coordination, that sort of thing. It's precisely, I mean, this actually demonstrates what Alan's point was at the beginning, which is you don't know the answer unless you actually know what the question is. And if the question is crime, you know, we will at some point reach a kind of stasis tolerable level, but we're never going to get rid of crime on the internet any more than we're going to get rid of it on you know, on the streets of Newark.
And so in both of your judgments, I mean, Alan raised this issue at the beginning, you raised it in this now. What is, I mean, of all the problems that we group under the word cybersecurity, which are the ones that we should actually be really worried about and doing something about, and which are the ones that we should just say, you know, life is complicated and we're going to tolerate levels of risk about it.
You want to go first?
So, sure. I mean, so each of, I identify sort of three major buckets. There's cybercrime, there is national security, and there's economic espionage. On the cybercrime side, the challenge is what are the systemic risks? So how close are we to banking fraud requiring either a massive rollout of a new identity infrastructure because we can no longer trust username and passwords, or just turning off web banking in general? So that's, you want to worry about what are your risks, what are your systemic risks as opposed to the criminal risks. This is the equivalent of the real world of people stop going downtown because crime is bad. You don't care about muggings individually, you care about the collapse that comes from real estate price fall. On the national security side, it's how do you rethink our entire approach of forcing privately held infrastructures to introduce inefficiencies from resiliency. And I have a hunch that Paul may agree with me that the final point on economic espionage really is the critical question. And my own research has been looking at how do we measure the pathways to harm, because we really don't know too much about what's going on. We know that there are massive amounts of data being stolen from American companies today. And we're pretty sure it's China, as well as other countries. What we don't know is how that translates into exact loss, right? If I have plans for an airplane that it took me $300 million to design and test, and you copy those, how much have I lost? Well, that depends on a lot of other assumptions about who's doing the copying, how well they're able to exploit it, and what industry I am. So we need to understand that. I have current work on that. And then the second question is, how do we get people to care about this? In as much as I, as a taxpayer, should care if a federally funded, you know, new fighter jet design is stolen from Boeing, say, you know who should care more? Boeing shareholders. And we don't really see a market push to care about economic espionage. And that's the real policy worry that I have. Recently, Senate Democrats on the Commerce Committee wrote a letter to the SEC saying, tell us about these cyber breaches and whether they're not material. Now, again, not being a lawyer, I'm especially not a securities lawyer. But the response seemed to be, well, material breaches are material. Chairwoman Shapiro had a very interesting comment, which is, we haven't seen much demand from investors. And that really shook me, that this is not something that the investment community cares about. And we've seen major attacks against people inside the defense industrial base, people with large cyber presences that have really targeted their business. There hasn't been much market response.
I think I'd agree. To my mind, the crime piece is endemic. And crime is crime. You know, McAfee estimated the losses worldwide in 2010 at $1 trillion from crime, identity theft and fraud. You know, that's a wild guess, but even if it's in the right order of magnitude, that's a lot of money. But in a worldwide economy, that doesn't bring down the world. I've already expressed my skepticism about cyber warfare being imminent. The real money spot is in espionage, both economic and national security espionage. And as Alan said, the Chinese are stealing us blind. It's systemic. They've lost all but the fig leaf of deniability, kind of like the U.S. drone program in Pakistan, if you will. No, it's almost the exact same thing. It's officially not ours, but everybody except the president admits it, and even our president
sort of admits it.
And it goes everywhere. The amazing thing about the Chinese economic espionage is that it's not just focused at big guys. You're unsurprised. One of the hacks was known as Night Dragon, and it involved stealing the bids of American and Western oil companies for oil and gas leases in the South China Sea, which, surprisingly, the Chinese National Oil Company underbid them by just enough to win all the leases, or overbid them by just enough to win all the leases. Now, that is big, right? But Jim Lewis of CSIS tells a wonderful story about a furniture company in Pennsylvania. Small company, 30 employees, $100 million in business, whatever. They make specialized tables via very fine wood. Their designs were stolen by somebody, and 6 months later, they were facing knockoffs that were being imported from China at half the price. End of story for the company. It's rampant, but here again, if that's the question, the answer is that somewhere America needs to find the policy and diplomatic initiative to confront China about it. We don't need a massive regulatory regime of cyber best practices to stop espionage. What we need is somebody to look the Chinese in the eye and say, if you don't stop, we will do X, whatever X is that we think is the right lever. Of course, we're reluctant to do that for a lot of extraneous reasons that involve the correlation of forces and they own $1 trillion of our debt. I mean, who knows why we don't do this? But so long as they can keep stealing data without suffering any adverse consequences, they'll keep stealing the data, and there'll be no adverse consequences. So that's where I would focus it, not on the defensive measures, because no matter how much of defense we do, the offense will always keep getting ahead too. We'll never catch them. So it's got to be cutting it off at the source.
So what do you expect the next few weeks during this legislative session looks like? Does Reed end up getting a bill? Does or is this the latest example of something that we thought was not a partisan issue that turns out to be sufficiently partisan that we can't get anything done?
Well, nobody ever made any money betting on predictions in the Senate who have only two speeds, dead stop and warp, right? So a compromise of some sort could happen overnight and we could have a unanimous consent to pass a new bill that nobody's read. That having been said, I am of the view that unless the administration says it's willing to take half a loaf and do, you know, education, FISMA reform, criminal law reform, and information sharing, which are the pieces that are kind of common and, except for information sharing, utterly unobjectionable, unless they're willing to say that they'll take that half a loaf, if they send Reed off to battle to get the whole enchilada, including the regulatory structure, they won't even get to start the bill because the rules of the debate won't, you know, the motion to proceed to the bill won't get the necessary 60 votes to break cloture there. That's my fear, so it may be kind of, you know, all this anticipation and a fizzle.
Politically, this is, it's a very interesting turn of events. It's the last 2 years, we've seen, I think, this Congress and last Congress, over 40 bills introduced in both chambers. But the, so now that it's actually come to a head, to see it suddenly emerge as a partisan issue, it's a little bit strange. The other thing that's amusing or slightly ironic is the biggest concern of a lot of observers of this debate was that there had been so much fear, uncertainty, and doubt sown that there are a bunch of very senior people who have just said, the sky is falling, the power will go out in the Northeast during winter unless we do something now. And there was a lot of fear that it would be, you know, we must do something, this is something, oh look, we must do this, and there would have been a lot of very large checks written without any good happening. And now to have it suddenly become fit into very familiar tropes of regulation versus not regulation is a little bit interesting, and I have to confess, I was surprised by it. I think it will be hard, given the administration's emphasis that this is a very important problem, it's a very complex problem, and that we need to start working on it now, it will be hard to walk back fully from a political position that the appropriate policy is to think about this from a risk-based perspective.
I think that it's actually, this is going to be another one of the episodes of who gets the blame in the public sphere. I think something's going to, they're going to try, because if they don't try and put something on the floor and something bad happens, everybody will blame the do-nothing Congress. If they do try and put it on the floor, and it doesn't work, at least from their perspective, the Republicans will be able to say it was the Democratic overreach, and the Democrats will be able to say it's the Republican recalcitrance, and at least they'll be able to say, I had the right answer. Yeah, it's the other guy who was wrong. I think it is unfortunate, especially since, I mean, to my mind, there's a 60% solution that if it were came up all by itself, would get 80 votes in the Senate and 375 votes in the House, and it wouldn't be a panacea. It's no silver bullet. None of it is. I mean, you know, cyber education is a long-term play that we need to fix desperately. That won't work until the kids who are in kindergarten today are, you know, coming out of graduate school in 20 years. But we know we got to fix it, and we got to start doing better work there. And the fact that we can't even break off those pieces that are kind of uniform, wildly agreed upon, is a is an unfortunate commentary. So just say yes, guys. Just say yes.
And I'd push back a little bit. I feel that the information sharing, permission for information sharing is nice, but even that won't do much productively until you at least have some proposal of what we're doing with this information. And I think they're broader issues, right? So vulnerability information is incredibly difficult to share. And right now, the current approach is anything on vulnerability information that is shared, if it's shared on the civilian side, everyone gets better, right? We get patched. It gets shared with the vendors. If it gets shared outside the civilian side, it becomes weaponized, and we all stay vulnerable. That's a long-term battle in the intelligence community, you know, OPSEC versus operational security versus information gathering. I think there really are challenges of what do you mean by information sharing, and the legal side I very much take to be an important part, and the privacy side. I agree with you that I think the McCain bill seems to be a little better on. But I don't see a good regime of actually using the information shared.
It's actually why I sort of like the private-to-private authorizations better than the private-to-government. Mm-hmm. To my mind, the precisely what you say, right. Some of it gets held back, government's slow. U.S. CERT is routinely about 30 days behind the private sector. Right. U.S. CERT is the U.S. Computer Emergency Response Team. It's the public sector alert warning system. It's routinely behind the private sector because they have to make sure that they're right and jot and tittle and do everything right. When the private sector, in the limited circumstances they're allowed to share now,
just ask.
They just say, here, and it comes with caveats. We're not sure.
We're going to stop there. Thank you both. This was very helpful, and appreciate you both doing it.
Good fun. Thank you.
It was a lot of fun. Thank you, man.
Thank you for listening to the Lawfare Podcast, a project of the Harvard Law School Brookings Project on Law and Security. Our music was performed by Sophia Yan.